Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, September 14th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. We're also available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with Affinity Konar about her new novel, Mischling. But first up, debut novelist Swan Huntley. Swan earned her MFA from Columbia University. She's received fellowships from the McDowell Colony and the Ragdale Foundation. Her debut novel is We Could Be Beautiful, published by Doubleday. And I am so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Swan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start off by having you introduce your book to us. Would you tell us about the story?
Sure. So the book, my one-sentence elevator pitch about it is that it's about a woman who meets a man who turns out not to be who she wanted him to be. And a little bit more on that is that it's told from the point of view of a 43-year-old woman who desperately wants a family. And so the clock is kind of ticking, and she meets a man who she trusts immediately. It turns out that they have ties. They've never met, but their families have been have a history. And then things develop from there, perhaps not in the way that she wants.
And the voice, Catherine's voice, she tells the story, and it's so much fun to read. I chuckled out loud a lot when I was reading, and it seemed like it was fun to write too. So could you talk about finding the voice for Catherine?
Sure. I mean, I think in a way it's kind of almost hard for me to answer that question. I feel like a lot of it just kind of happens while I'm sitting at my computer. A lot of it is subconscious. Like, I don't necessarily think out everything beforehand, but I knew that I wanted it to be in the first person. I think with this project, and just in general as a writer, I tend to be interested in the space between what a character is telling us and what we know to be true. And I feel like the first person is just such a great way to play with that.
And beyond that, getting inside Catherine's idiosyncrasies and her disconnect from the world, because she's a one percenter and she has these funny ideas about monogrammed silk pajamas that she got from an idea that she carries on from her mother. And so could you talk about the inspiration for the story?
Sure. So this story has a very particular inspiration. I was working as a nanny in Soho for a wealthy family. And when I was leaving that job after 7 months, which happens to be my magical job number every time it's 7 months. It's like time for me to go. And so when I was leaving that job, I wrote this young child, I think she was 18 months old at the time, a letter, because I started thinking about how strange it would be that we could run into each other years down the road and I would know so much about this person's life and family and history, and she would have no idea who I was. And so I wrote her a letter, just kind of telling her about the stuff that we had done together and the time that we spent together. And then I started thinking that that would be an interesting idea for a book, if there were a letter like that that contained information that would have an influence on present circumstances. So a lot of people have asked me if in this original letter I was warning this young girl of doom to come. I was not. But then the task for the book became figuring out what would be in that letter. So that's really what prompted me.
Would you be able to read to us from the book?
Sure. There was something familiar about him. Maybe he looked like an actor, or maybe he was just one of those people who looked familiar to everyone. Or maybe his drag queen scent reminded me of home. "It's nice to see you," he said finally. His voice was smooth and cool, like metal brilliantly polished. He held out his hand. On his pinky was a ring, a turquoise stone on a tarnished silver band. That intrigued me. It seemed out of place and special. It suggested a character. Do I know you? William Stockton. Catherine West. I remember his hand felt as smooth and as cool as his voice. I remember thinking, there's something about this guy. There's some kind of electricity between us. It was big, enormous, unavoidable. In the very beginning, it felt like a current pulling me blissfully toward a whirlpool. Before you drown, the spinning just feels like a dance.
Thank you. That was Swan Huntley reading from her debut novel, We Could Be Beautiful, published by Doubleday. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. At the end of the scene when William introduces himself, so his character's name is William Stockton. She's Catherine West. And I think there's something about the character names in this novel, too, that seem carefully considered. Can you talk a little bit about naming your characters and how those choices came?
Sure. With William, I wanted a name that could be both regal and a little bit serial killer-ish. That was how I chose William Stockton. And then with Catherine, I wanted something regal and, well, kind of stately and simple. And I happened to be at a residency, and somebody's last name was West. So I stole that.
And Catherine and her sister Carolyn's mother has Alzheimer's. She's in the fairly early stages, but you leverage that disease for both suspense and for comedy sometimes. And can you talk about working with that as a plot element and whether it posed challenges?
Sure. I really like the idea of the answer being right there and Catherine not being able to get at it. I think it speaks to the larger theme of denial, of Catherine having this feeling that maybe William is not as great as she wants to believe that he is, but her not being able to fully grasp that. And I think it works the same way with the Alzheimer's. It's like right there, but she can't quite get to it. And I had a lot of fun writing those scenes. I had worked with somebody with Alzheimer's, and so I used some of what I learned there to put into Catherine's mother.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting choice because there's the danger of making fun, but you don't do that. And I can see how she's useful as an unreliable, not narrator, but a source of information. So I read in an interview that the ending of the book is not the original ending. And so could you talk about how and why it changed? I mean, broadly, without giving spoilers, but I'm curious about that when it happens.
Sure. So the original ending was a very dark ending. And we sent it out to a bunch of people, probably like 10 people, and they all said the same thing, which was, this is not fitting. And my immediate reaction to that was, oh my gosh, they're trying to commercialize me and, you know, and take this, and that's why they're taking this out. And so I felt very defensive, and I felt like I'm never changing that. And then I really, you know, spent a couple days thinking about it and talked to the person who is now my editor about why the original ending actually didn't make sense. And it didn't make sense from a psychological perspective. And when I realized that my original ending included something that, like, William character would never actually do, then I thought, okay, that they're right. I really do need to change this ending. I also think when everybody is telling you the exact same thing, it might be a time to listen, is what I learned from that.
For the first version, had you outlined the story, or did it just emerge from writing it?
So this is the first book for which I created an outline. I had written two books previous to this. One was my thesis for my MFA, and then I wrote another one. With both of those, I was still completely sure, like, this is it. This is going to be it. No, they're now in my drawer, which I I can't believe I'm saying that with no emotion because I was so angry about that for so long. But so with this book, I didn't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write an outline. But what I was telling myself while writing it was, okay, things really need to happen in this book, because the feedback that I kept getting over and over with the first two was, these are nice characters, this is kind of nice, but nothing is happening. And so after I wrote part one of this book, I just kind of found myself at the counter, like, cutting up little pieces of paper and taping them to a larger piece of paper. I found myself outlining, basically. I was like, oh, I'm outlining. And that turned out to be the most useful thing. And I'm so glad that I did it, and I will continue to do it from now on.
How about short stories? Did you ever, because there's that thing that gets said about short stories sometimes, is that they're a way for authors to learn how to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Did you ever use them that way, or how do you feel about short stories?
I feel like short stories are a great way to begin. And I think they're especially useful when you are studying creative writing in college or in grad school or in any capacity, because it's just easier to have a whole thing to look at. It gets very confusing when you start so many chapters and you have to explain what comes before and after. I think, and so I wrote short stories in college and in grad school, but I think the novel just came more naturally to me. I think that the pressure of having everything, in a short story, everything needs to be used. You know, you can't really kind of go off on a tangent. It feels like there should not be much wasted space, if any. And that, to me, just always felt like a little bit too much pressure.
Yeah, I'm talking to Swan Huntley about her debut novel, We Could Be Beautiful. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. So in reading, do you prefer also to read novels as opposed to short stories?
I read all kinds of stuff. I read all kinds of stuff. So I definitely read both. I'm reading a short story collection by Sarah Majka right now, which I really like.
And can you tell us how you got an agent story?
Yes. So by the time I actually got an agent, I had gone through this process two times with the first two books that are now in my drawer. I wish they were actually in a drawer taking up space, but they're just in a computer file, which is kind of even worse. But so by this time, I had a really good sense of who was out there. I think once you start looking at the list of agents in New York and even elsewhere, but they just mostly happen to be in New York, you realize it's kind of a small pool of people. And so by the time I sent this book out, I really kind of knew what I wanted. I wanted somebody who was maybe not super established, but who was like a young up-and-comer, and I'd also just heard great things about my agent, Allison. And so I sent it out to probably like five agents. And with the first two books, I was doing it more blindly. I went to like querytracker.net and agentquery.com. I think those are correct. And I sent it to like 10 or 15. I just like, you know, massive send. And this one I had a smaller group. And I also really knew that I wanted Allison to be my agent. And so I was very happy that she said yes.
Did she give you editorial notes before you sent it out or not?
You know, I expected her to, and she did not. And I'm really, really grateful for that, because I think that given what happened, then I ended up rewriting the whole last third of the book. Mm-hmm. If I had started the process doing a revision before doing that, I might have dampened my spirit.
And I wanted to ask you your take on categories, because this book is often called a psychological thriller. And I'm wondering your reaction to that and also your stance on labels in general and whether you consider them when you're writing or what your opinion is.
I definitely haven't considered them while writing. This is my first book, so all of this categorizing stuff is new to me. Participating with it in this way anyway is new to me. I didn't actually learn that I wrote a psychological thriller until it came out and people started asking me why I wrote a thriller. And I don't know. I don't have many feelings on that. I think it does fit into that category in a way. I think it's also very much a character study. And I think it's just easier to pick a category and label it and put it in a bookstore or, you know, subdivide it on Amazon. It just makes it easier for people to understand, obviously. So I'm okay with my psychological thriller label.
And Swan, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, do you have any writing advice for our listeners?
Oh, I would say the sooner you can make friends with your doubt, the better. Like just accepting that doubt is a huge part of this has been helpful for me. I started something new recently, and I realized, and every time I start something new, I'm sitting there thinking, how do I do this? Can I do this? How have I done this before? And I actually like the way that Elizabeth Gilbert talks about this. She has this kind of funny, creepy metaphor where she's driving a van and doubt is a shadowy figure in a hoodie in the back seat, and he will never get out of the van, and the van's like the novel or your project. And every once in a while, she like nods at him in the rear view and just says hi, knowing that he's never going to get out of the van. I really like that for some reason.
Well, Swan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was debut author Swan Huntley. Her novel is We Could Be Beautiful, published by Doubleday. During the second part of the show, author Affinity Konar will be here, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with writer Swan Huntley. Next up, author Affinity Konar. Affinity has an MFA in fiction from Columbia University. She's the author of the novel The Illustrated Version of Things, and her new novel is Mishling, published by Lee Boudreau Books. I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Affinity.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Very thrilled.
To start us off, could you introduce this book to us?
Sure. Mishling is the story of two 12-year-old girls who find themselves taken captive at Auschwitz, and they fall under the wing of the angel of death, Joseph Mengele. And the book follows their struggles to survive within the camp. And I hope that it also just highlights the bond between them. That's the most important feature of the book to me.
How did you come to this story, to this time?
I first read of the story of the Twins of Auschwitz when I was about 16 in a book called Children of the Flames, which I just highly recommend to everyone. It was a book that continued to haunt me, even though I read it at that very young age. It was one of those books that you weren't ever able to stop thinking about. And I wasn't exactly thinking that someday I will write a novel about this. But the story just compelled me over and over again to look at the narratives surrounding this history. I was just never able to shake it. even when I didn't feel as if I was able to approach the material in a novel. So it's been a very long-term obsession of mine.
So you carried the story around with you for years, and then once you started writing it, how did you metabolize the material? What I'm trying to get at is the New York Times review called your gaze on the atrocities of Auschwitz unflinching, and that felt like the right description to me. And so as the author, I'm wondering how you balanced this unflinching focus on these horrific things with being able just to function in your daily life.
I think one of the saddest things that I can say about the process with this book is that it can never touch on the true horror and sort of deciding which atrocities to depict within the book was one of my greatest tasks. And sorting through that sort of material is something that just never leaves you. I think looking at the photographs was absolutely the worst. And I would often have to sort of resort to reading Holocaust poetry immediately after doing this kind of research. It was the only sort of thing that, it wasn't comfort, but it was being able to look at how poetry can sort of suspend this pain within language. And that became one of my coping mechanisms, was just to go back and forth between the research and poetry and literature.
Would you read to us from Mischling?
Sure. I'm going to go ahead and read from the opening chapter. It's called World After World. We were made once, my twin Pearl and me. Or, to be precise, Pearl was formed and I split from her. She embossed herself on the womb. I copied her signature. For 8 months, we were afloat in an amniotic snowfall, two rosy mittens resting on the lining of our mother. I couldn't imagine anything grander than the womb we shared, but after the scaffolds of our brains were ivoried and our spleens were complete, Pearl wanted to see the world beyond us. And so, with newborn pluck, she spat herself out of our mother. Though premature, Pearl was a sophisticated prankster. I assured myself that it was just one of her tricks. She'd be back to laugh at me. But when Pearl failed to return, I lost my breath. Have you ever had to live with the best part of yourself adrift, stationed at some unknowable distance? If so, I am sure you're aware of the dangers of this condition. After my breath left me, my heart followed suit, and my brain ran with an unthinkable fever. In my fetal pinkness, I faced this truth. Without her, I would become a split and unworthy thing, a human incapable of love. That is why I followed my sister's lead and allowed the doctor's hands to tear me out and smack me and hold me to the light. Let us note that I never cried during the ruptures of this unwanted transition. Not even when our parents ignored my wish to be named Pearl II. I became Stasha instead, and with the chore of birth complete, we entered the world of family and piano and book, of days that baffled by in beauty. We were so alike. We were always dropping marbles from the window onto the paving stones and watching them descend the hill with our binoculars, just to see how far their little lives would take them. That world, teeming with awe, ended too. Most worlds do. But I must tell you, there was another world we knew. Some say it was the world that made us the most. I want to say that they are wrong, but for now, let me tell you that our entry into this world began in our 12th year of life, when we were huddled side by side in the back of a cattle car. During that journey of 4 days and 4 nights, we cheated our way into survival under Mama's and Zadie's instruction. For sustenance, we passed an onion back and forth and licked its yellow hide. For entertainment, we played the game Zeta had made for us, a game called The Classification of Living Things. In this form of charades, you had to portray a living thing, and the players had to name the species, the genus, the family, and so on, all the way to the encompassing brilliance of a kingdom. The four of us passed through so many living things in the cattle car. We postured from bear to snail and back. It was important that we organize the universe to the best of our two human ability. And when the cattle car finally came to a stop, I stopped my charade too. The way I remember it, I was in the middle of trying to convince Mama that I was an amoeba. It's possible that I was portraying some other living thing, and that I am remembering it as an amoeba only now because I felt so small in that moment, so translucent and fragile. I cannot be sure. Just as I was about to admit defeat, the door to the cattle car rolled open.
Thank you. That was Affinity Konar, reading from her new novel, Mishling, published by Lee Boudreaux Books. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And so the book is structured with alternating points of view, and the section you just read to us is from Stasha's point of view, one of the twins. Can you talk about coming to that structure where the twins would alternate the story?
I think that structure was one of the very first things that I arrived at when I began to start to think of approaching this story. It was very natural. There was like no hesitation about it. All the other things that I spent so much time negotiating, this one was an immediate choice. How to calibrate the voices was another matter. But I knew from the very beginning that I wanted Stasha to have a sort of raw, emotive voice, to be a dreamer and a rebel, and that I wanted Pearl to sort of carry a very precise perspective. And because I first heard them almost in conversation when I started to write the book, it was a very easy choice. I couldn't imagine doing it any other way.
I understand that originally the characters of the twins were boys. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that choice? I thought was fascinated by that.
Yeah, when I first heard the sort of dialogue between these twins within the camp, much of it was focused on, you know, just daily routine, how to survive, how to steal a potato, how to trick a nurse. And that conversation, as I originally heard it, was between two boys. And I think part of that could have been coming from the fact that I was deeply inspired by these interviews with survivors, and one statement in particular was made by a boy named Peter, and he was 11 years old, and he reflected about this time that I should mention that all the twins within the camp were given these very small, almost useless pocket knives that they could use to cut their bread. And the Nazis didn't see that as any threat to give these children pocket knives. But this boy, Peter, just said, you know, I kept sharpening that knife, and I had this fantasy that when the time came, I was going to take at least one SS man with me with that knife. And that statement had just clung to me for so many years. I sort of naturally thought of them as boys, and it was also, you know, probably coming from a childhood of reading a lot of male-oriented fiction as well. And when I found myself questioning the impulse to make them boys, the whole world of the novel just opened up. And, you know, something very strange happened when I handed that pocket knife to a little girl. It felt very freeing to write the narrative. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine them any other way. It feels as if that's how they were from the very beginning, but...
Yeah, and I think that's why I was so struck when I heard that. I thought, wait a minute. Can you talk about the title, both what it means and finding it as the right one for the book?
Mm. Well, I first encountered the word when I was very young, and I remember just being really struck by the sound of it alone. I mean, for me, I'm always going sort of sound first for a word. I don't know if that's because I, you know, sort of taught myself to read at an age and didn't really process words properly as they should have been. But I was attracted to the sound of it, and then you look up the meaning of it, and it is so incredibly ugly. It is a term that was used by the Third Reich to classify Jews of mixed heritage and mixed blood. And it was a word that I just kept returning to while writing the novel. And I wanted Stasha to sort of challenge the word, to use it as a disguise with Mengele, because someone who is Mischling would have an advantage with someone like that doctor, criminal. And I wanted her to sort of interrogate the meaning at different points throughout the novel and then reject it. At the same time, I think that it's sort of an important word to kind of cradle in your palm. It's a word to be scared by. I think it prepares the reader for a novel that, while the novel is searching for beauty, these are very horrific events. So I think it almost braces people, or that's what I would hope it would do.
Hmm. And so, do you speak German and or Polish or Russian?
No, I do not. That was actually a big struggle for me, and I went over to Poland recently. My father's side of the family is Polish. I was deeply embarrassed by my lack of facility with the language. I can sing a few songs, but that's about it. But, you know, I've always sort of just been like a collector of words, and foreign or not, maybe sometimes even more so, I'm attracted if it's a word outside of English. So it was very satisfying to cull certain words that I came across while doing research and incorporate them into the narrative.
Yeah, because there are, it's economically parsed throughout the book, just very choice words. And I was wondering if that was a discussion with your editors, because Stasha and Pearl would actually have been speaking Polish to each other, but speaking German to Mengele. And so I was wondering whether that was a thought to include more ever or not.
That was a sort of subject of discussion. You know, it's very sort of, it's difficult territory to negotiate. And, you know, I also, like, had a real time with kind of just toning down my Americanisms, you know, especially when you're having children speak to each other and you want them to speak sort of in a free fashion. I really had to rein that in. But the discussion of, you know, language within the camps is itself just such an interesting one, the sort of slang that was developed. It's kind of fascinating to see how people communicated without everyone knowing the natural language, and how sort of relationships were formed within the camps that helped inform each other's survival just through language alone.
Yeah, and then Yiddish also plays a sort of dramatic role at one point. But there's another split in the book. We talked about the alternating points of view, but then there's another split, and I thought this was interesting since the book is about twins and splitting and coming together. And it's in the middle of the book when Auschwitz is liberated. And so I was wondering about the time frame of the story and whether it was something you always had in mind that would be the span, or could you talk about the time frame?
Sure. The book took me many years to write. It took about 10 years on and off, certainly not steadily, but I was always just sort of returning to it. And a lot of that sort of delay in finishing was due to the question of the time frame of part two. I always envisioned it as having two parts. At one point, it had three. And I threw out that sort of latter half of the book twice. And I always wanted to do something about post-liberation. I was drawn to that period partly because one of the first Levy books that I read was actually The Truce rather than Survival in Auschwitz. That was my introduction to his work. And so I was just immediately captivated by this question of how is a survivor supposed to cope with a world that has completely turned their back on them? That compelled me through part two. I would keep returning to that question even though I had drafts that were set in a different period of time. I actually had one that saw the twins as adults far into the future. But I found that this was the most interesting and immediate path for me to take. I wanted to just sort of stay in the moment with them, and I don't know if that was my personal attachment to them, but for some reason, just staying within the immediate months after the war felt right to me.
I'm talking to Affinity Konar about her new novel, Mischling. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And now, Affinity, this is your second novel, and I'm wondering about how the experience of getting it published was different from the experience you had with your first novel.
Oh, I mean, it is such a strange thing to think about, because I was writing this book before the book that is actually was published before. So I always tend to think of this as my first book. And it's, you know, I've worked on it for so many years that it's interesting to try to even sort out a timeline with that. But, I mean, my first published book, The Illustrated Version of Things, that experience was really interesting. I felt like I learned a lot about, I don't know, I feel like I couldn't have really written this book without having written that one. I feel like I was able to sort of grow from that experience in a way that I didn't expect to. I came from a place where I was obsessed with getting word by word right. And this book, my objective is to let a little more air in and to write, maybe not word by word, sometimes not even sentence by sentence, but to look for the full effect so that I could honor the story rather than simply language. And, you know, the publishing experience itself has been dramatically different. I am a very sort of shy person, so networking is not something that comes naturally to me, and that's something that's very necessary when you publish with a small press. And I'm really indebted to Fiction Collective 2 for publishing that novel. And it also just taught me how to sort of approach my work, that whole experience.
Were you working with an agent for the sale of both of those books, or the same agent?
No, I actually, my agent, Jim Rutman, he saw that novel, The Illustrated Version of Things, and he got in touch with me, and we had just sort of a remarkable exchange over a period of years. Like, I've never heard of someone investing in an author the way he invested in me. You know, we spoke about how I might apply my interests differently on the page. You know, he would provide feedback in a way that I never anticipated receiving. He's just this very kind of intelligent assessment of my work, and I'm just outrageously indebted to him for caring about my process so much. And I just, when I was finished with this novel, which I was working on very secretly, there was just no question that I would go to him. So that's how he assisted in that process, even though he wasn't really aware of the existence of the novel. And I felt very sort of badly about that when I told him. And he said, this is what you've been working on all these years? You know, because I had a lot of hesitations about showing anybody. Mm-hmm. But he was someone that I immediately trusted, and I'm just very grateful.
Well, Affinity, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I want to ask whether you have any writing advice for the writers listening.
I think that just sort of it's old advice that I've clung to over the years, and I've struggled with because of the subject matter of this book. But, you know, it's simply just to honor your obsessions. To never attempt to write something that you don't truly care about. That's, I think that when you start doing that and you start trying to play to an audience that you think might want to read you, that will lead you very much astray. And if you just honor that obsession, some beautiful things can happen.
Well, Affinity, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a real shock to me to still be speaking about this, so thank you.
That was Affinity Konar, author of the new novel, Mischling, published by Leigh Boudreau Books. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Barbara will interview memoirist and Tin House editor Rob Spillman about his book, All Tomorrow's Parties, and New York City literary agent Lee Eisenman. Stay tuned for Suspended on Silver Wings, Moon Pop with DJ Uni B, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.